And welcoming you, dear listeners, to your Sunday morning session here in my company, all the way from 5 a.m. technically, up to 7 a.m. here on your number one talk radio station, that being Eagle FM. And this is my Sunday morning take, as we obviously take a look at the last particular Sunday of April, and its particular conversation point that we've got planned for this morning here on your number one talk radio station, that being Eagle FM. And ultimately, as you've just exited from the particular tunes of New Guinea with the song Gilby, before that was a little bit of Marvin Gaye. Well, it technically was on Marvin Gaye because it comes actually from the, it was like a compilation particular album, but the song's name was My Funny Valentine. Before that, you had a little bit of Tired of Being Alone from the great particular Al Green. And before that, it was a little bit of Aaron Fraser with the song Dime featuring Kanka Musa. Now, for this particular session this morning, as we always do, we take a look at a little bit of science, a little bit of history. Well, no, a lot of history, a little bit of science, a lot of geography, and a little bit of everything else in between in terms of understanding some of the particular developments that have happened in history, in the world, or that are probably currently happening right now as we're going through this particular day of the 27th of April. Now, just highlighting to you, dear listeners, that today's particular edition and session primarily takes a little bit of a look at a war scenario, as we've done in other particular previous sessions of my Sunday morning take. This one for this morning technically plays as the prelude, or it plays as the prelude to the Second World War, as a connector between the two world wars, and technically also as a precursor to the new way in terms of how the modern day world is structured. If you don't know what I'm talking about, today is a little bit of a shallow dive, because it's not going to be very deep, of the Spanish Civil War. Now, the Spanish Civil War, dear listeners, if you've never heard of it, happened between 1936 to 1939. It was fought primarily by the Republicans and the Nationalists in Spain. And the Republicans were anti-monarchy, because if you don't know, currently, or, you know, in this particular session of, you know, the modern day government of Spain, is that Spain has a king. Now, back in 1931, ultimately, Spain sort of like moved from the... it was not just 1931. There was also a period slightly earlier during the First World War. But Spain moved away from its monarchy system. And they literally had a government. These were the Republicans. And the whole scenario was open to elections and the likes, and, you know, things were going on. Not that they don't have elections today, but the Spanish, they do have elections, but you can only vote for a prime minister, for that matter. And the whole particular scenario has been, just establishing a format of governance that ultimately fits with the times that you can obviously see were present back then in the Spain that we see also now today. Now, the key thing about the Spanish Civil War was literally yesterday's 26 April's particular sort of like remembrance of the event that sort of like brings this to the light. This particular event, obviously, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, is focal and is found within the Spanish Civil War scenario. Now, it is known as the bombing of Guernica, because on 26 April, which was yesterday, 1937, the Basque town of Guernica was aerially bombed during the Spanish Civil War. Now, it was carried out at the behest of Francisco Franco, who was the guy that then later on became the dictator of Spain. He, you know, was technically the guy just below the king of Spain. And the particular bombing was carried out by the German Luftwaffe's Condor Legion, because the Germans and the Italians on that stage during the Spanish Civil War were allies of Franco, the nationalist leader in the Spanish Civil War. Now, it happened under the particular operation by the name of Operation Regan. This is now the particular bombing that took place. And the town itself, known as Guernica,
did you know that in Namibia, over 1.4 million people use their mobile device to access the internet? So why not meet your current and potential customers where they already are? With over 600,000 cumulative users around the world, between the Eagle FM and Imba mobile apps, Eagle Media House has the perfect digital platforms for you to advertise your business, upcoming events, weddings, vacancies, funerals, or any other announcement that you have on their digital billboards in their mobile applications. Put your ad on our digital billboards and with one tap of the screen, lead users directly to an address of your choosing. For more information, contact Hende at 081-410-9077. That's 081-410-9077.
Now, coming back from that quick sort of like break there right there, dear listeners, ultimately, you know, it's not particularly easy, you know, living with a little bit of sinus that ultimately spells your downfall for a particular Sunday morning session. But you know what? We soldier on. Now, the bombing of Guernica that took place on 26 April 1937 obviously is the particular sort of like this day in history event that took place. Now, what made this primarily a little bit stand out? Because if you've got to ask me, so what is so special about Guernica? Has been the scenario that the town was being used as a communication center by the Republican forces just behind the front line. So, obviously, the other belligerent in the discussion, which were the Republicans, because Franco was the nationalist. The nationalists were supported by Mussolini's armed forces, which were known as the Italian Aviazione Legionaria. And the German Luftwaffe's Condor Legion, who were assisting in terms of, you know, giving aerial support to Franco and his, Franco's forces were known specifically as the Nationalist Faction. Now, the particular bombing that obviously took place was that the raid was intended to destroy bridges and roads, because these are obviously communication and supply routes and infrastructure that are critical in terms of, you know, providing supplies. Into and out of the town of Guernica. Now, the operation opened the way to Franco's particular capture of the port city of Bilbao, which is one of Spain's largest port cities, and his particular victory in northern Spain. Now, the attack also gained controversy because it involved the bombing of civilians by a military air force. Now, this was seen as a war crime by some historians, and it was argued as a legitimate attack by others, and was also one of the first aerial bombings to capture global attention. Now, under the international laws regarding aerial warfare in 1937, Guernica was a legitimate military target. If you're now looking for these particular sort of like justification elements that help describe, you know, what makes a legitimate target. Now, the number of victims are still disputed. The Basque government at the time reported at least 1,654 people had lost their lives at the time, while local historians had identified it to be just as much as 126 victims. And it was later on revised by other authors of the same study to be at least 153. A British source used by the U.S. Air Force Air War College claims it to be at least 400 civilians that had passed away. Soviet archives, because the Soviets were helping the Republicans, while the Nazi Germany was helping the Nationalists and Fascist Italy was helping the Nationalists on the other side. And the other forces that were on the ground trying to help the Republicans were all, they were known as the International Brigade or something. Think of it as like what happened with the establishment of ISIL in 2011, when a whole bunch of young people from Europe ran to Syria to go and fight a war against Bashar al-Assad, under the flag of the ISIS guys, just for them to find out that the ISIS guys are technically, you know, fundamentalists. And it's also similar to the developments that have happened here in the Ukraine conflict. The moment the conflict started, there's a whole bunch of mercenaries that are fighting on both sides, on the Russian side and on the Ukrainian side. And it's the same particular scenario. And this is ultimately what also happened in the Spanish Civil War. Now, one of the most famous sort of like faces that participated in the Spanish Civil War, his name is actually Ernest Hemingway. If you don't know who Ernest Hemingway is, he's also one of America's sort of like celebrated authors. He was also a journalist because he was a war correspondent, but it had been proven that during the Second World War, because he was dispatched to cover the Second World War as well, Homeboy was actually participating as an active. So he was an active participant, and it was one of the things that actually he could not get a specific kind of a military medal, but he was given a specific kind of a military medal meant for civilians, known as the Bronze Medal or something like that. And he was not supposed to participate as a combatant, as a civilian, because he was there as a journalist and not as a soldier for the American Air Force, for the American Army. But obviously things obviously changed in that regard. We're quickly going to take a short musical break, dear listeners, and we're going to come back right after that. And right there were the sounds of New Guinea once again with the song Marekia. Now, where we left off, dear listeners, just before the musical break and ultimately bringing you up to about 25 minutes out from the top of the hour at 6 a.m. Remember, you're in my company from 5 until 7 a.m. this lovely Sunday morning. Well, we're obviously building up primarily to the winter season, but nonetheless, you know, it still is a lovely morning outside. Where we left off, we highlighted obviously the amount of deaths that were recorded in the particular event of the city of Guernica in Spain, which ultimately was a particular sort of like stronghold for the Republicans of Spain versus the Nationalists of Spain. It was bombed by the German and Italian air forces that were in support of the Nationalist Spain movement, who were the other particular belligerent against the Republicans of Spain. Now, from the Guernica incident, we then move over to the Spanish Civil War, because the Spanish Civil War is literally the particular prelude to the Second World War. It is the event that led to the Second World War. It is that particular event of what happened in Guernica and, for example, the invasion of Ethiopia. Okay, but it wasn't Ethiopia back then. It was known as Abyssinia because they still had a king. Or he was technically an emperor. The invasion of Abyssinia in literally this particular period of the 1930s, by Mussolini as well, because Mussolini wanted colonial possessions. He was jealous of England and France, who still held on to theirs. And they were obviously still very powerful based upon these particular possessions. And he said he felt like, you know what, I also want something and I'm going to go get it. Which he technically did. He invaded Abyssinia. Now, Abyssinia was later on obviously liberated by the British forces who were obviously based in places like Kenya and Kenya and Sudan, obviously former British colonial possessions as well. And obviously the British could operate from out of those particular zones. They obviously had South Africa, which was another major particular British military support function. India was another one. Australia, New Zealand on another side of this particular spectrum. It was a pretty broad discussion. Even though the British were literally fighting probably the largest part of the global war, because they had to defend against the Japanese in Asia. So you had the Australians and, you know, the Indian command were literally fighting the Japanese in Asia. The American Navy only came later on because the American Navy had to help in the Pacific realm of the Second World War, while the American Army was in the European realm of the Second World War. And the American Army could only get there with the help of the British Navy, because the British Navy was obviously there. But the British Navy couldn't be in Asia, just like the American Navy could not be in the, European realm of the Second World War. Now, just obviously setting the scene regarding those particular developments that obviously took place from 1940 to 45, the Spanish Civil War in its own right was a little bit peculiar. Why I say it was a little bit peculiar, because the Spanish Civil War, as mentioned in the time frame, happened between 1936 to 1939. Now, it was as a result of a military revolt against the Republican government of Spain, which was supported by conservative elements within the country. Now, when an initial military coup failed to win control of the entire country, a bloody civil war then, you know, obviously kicked off. And this was fought with great ferocity on both sides. Now, the nationalists, who were considered to be the rebels, obviously, because they were the guys rebelling against the Republican government, received aid from fascist Italy and from Nazi Germany. The Republicans then also received a aid from the Soviet Union as well, from which also and they also received aid from the International Brigades. If you don't know what the International Brigades are, it's literally the explainer that I gave a little bit earlier, just before the musical break, that the International Brigades were literally a established group of foreign volunteer soldiers who fought on the Republican side against the Nationalist forces during the Spanish Civil War. So it was literally a campaign to invite extra boots on the ground to come and fight in this conflict. Similar thing to what the Ukrainians have been doing and the Russians have been doing. Obviously, the Russians have been contacting government-to-government negotiations, because that's how we discovered about the North Koreans on the ground. We also heard stories of the Indian soldiers on the ground, but these were more like guys that thought they were coming to come and do work, just for them to find out. It was not really a, you know, working holiday discussion. It was more like, come and, you know, fight the front lines for us discussion. And the members of this International Brigades discussion came from 50 countries, because they were recruited, organized, and directed by a communist international agency, who was headquartered in Paris. So they obviously represented the Republican side of things in Spain. Now, just getting back to the discussion, was that literally, the International Brigades was composed of volunteers from Europe and from the United States. And specifically, that a lot of them obviously responded to this particular call. But the unfortunate thing is, they were poorly supplied. The poor guys. They were mostly just infantry. They didn't have much hardware. Now, the war was an outcome of a polarization of Spanish life and politics that had developed over the previous decades. Remember, in the 1930s, was literally also the height of the Great Depression. So, you know, factor Spain into this particular scenario. On the one side, you had the nationalists, who were mostly Roman Catholic. That's obviously Francisco Franco's corner of this civil war. And they were important elements of the military. And they were mostly landowners in Spain. And many of them were also business people of Spain. So this was the established elite class and their support bases, technically, in Francisco Franco's corner. On the other side, the Republicans were mostly urban workers, mostly agricultural workers, and many of them were also educated middle class citizens and people of Spain. Politically, their differences often found extreme and, you know, very vehement expressions in parties such as the fascist-oriented Falange and the militant anarchists that existed at the time. Between these two extremes were also other groups that covered the political spectrum, from monarchism and conservatism through liberalism to socialism, which also included a small communist movement that divided among followers of the Soviet leader Joseph Stalin in his time, and his arch rival of the time, Leon Trotsky. You don't know who Leon Trotsky was. Trotsky was supposed to be supposedly he was supposed to be the guy to take over after Lenin passed away. And obviously, we all know that Joseph Stalin took over everything. Now, in 1934, there was also a widespread labor conflict and another bloody uprising by miners, you know, mine workers, in the region of Asturias in Spain, that was suppressed by soldiers that were led by General Francisco Franco. Franco was the main face of the nationalists. Now, a succession of governmental crises then also culminated in the elections that took place on 16 February 1936, which also brought to power a popular front government that was supported by most of the parties of the left and was opposed by the parties on the right and what remained of the center. These particular developments also obviously then led to a well-planned military uprising that began on 17 July of 1936, in which in garrison towns throughout Spain, by 21 July of that same year, the rebels had achieved control in Spanish Morocco. Now, I will explain why there was still this indication of Spanish Morocco. Well, here's the thing. Just like I said a little bit earlier in terms of what Mussolini did with Abyssinia, which was a combination of Somalia, Ethiopia, and Eritrea, modern day today. The Spanish still had some of their particular, you know, African possessions, which was literally Morocco. And they had military contingents or deposits in Morocco, which was actually where Franco was also based, because Franco was based in Morocco, if you ever read up on Franco himself. So what else actually happened was that the whole particular movement of the nationalists, which, you know, featured Franco, flowed from Spanish Morocco to the Canary Islands and then to the Balearic Islands, except for Minorca. And it then led into the part of Spain north of the Guadarrama Mountains and the Ebro River, but except for Asturias, Santander, and the Basque provinces along the north coast and the region of Catalonia in the northeast. Now, the Republican forces had also had to put down a uprising and uprisings in other areas. And it was literally connected to the same uprising that flowed in from Spanish Morocco. Now, they could not suppress the uprisings that obviously happened in the larger Andalusian cities, which included Sevilla, Granada, and Cordoba. Now, the nationalists and the republicans then proceeded to organize their respective territories and to repress opposition or suspected opposition. The republican violence occurred primarily during the early stages of the war, before the rule of law was actually restored. But the nationalist violence was part of a conscious policy of terror. You'll understand why if you ever read into Franco's particular, you know, rise to power as the dictator of Spain, even though he literally installed the king of Spain, the monarchy of Spain, back into their position as, you know, the leader of Spain. Franco literally controlled it from something like 1940 until 1975, which technically made him a dictator. That's why you can only now vote for Spanish prime ministers into office. So, the matter of how many were actually killed still remains a highly contentious discussion. But it is also generally believed that the toll of nationalist violence was higher, because the nationalists were obviously Franco side of guys. In any event, the proliferation of the executions, the murders, and the assassinations on both sides also reflected the great passions that were also unleashed during this particular civil war in Spain. So, the captaincy of the nationalists was gradually assumed by General Franco, because he came from the army. He was literally a military guy, a career soldier all his life. Now, he led the forces that he had brought over from Morocco, and on 1 October 1936, he was named head of state and set up a government in Burgos. Now, by establishing this, obviously, this government in Burgos, the Republican government, beginning in September 1936, was headed or led by the socialist leader Francisco Largo Caballero. Now, he was then followed in May of 1937 by Juan Negrin, also a socialist who remained premier throughout the remainder of the war and served as premier in exile until 1945. The president of the Spanish Republic until nearly the end of the war was Manuel Adana. And he was an anti-clerical liberal. You also had other particular conflict scenarios that obviously took place that comprised or that compromised the Republican effort from the onset or from the outset. Reason being that on one side were the anarchists and militant socialists who viewed the war as a revolutionary struggle and spearheaded widespread collectivization of agriculture, industry and services. And on the other side were the more moderate socialists and republicans whose objective was the preservation of the republic. Seeking allies also against the threat of Nazi Germany, the Soviet Union had embraced a popular front strategy. And as a result, the Comintern directed Spanish communists to support the republicans. Now, both the nationalist and republican sides, seeing themselves as being too weak to win a quick victory, turned abroad for help. So they immediately jumped to, you know, making use of allegiances and the likes internationally and, you know, started seeking immediate help in those regards. Germany and Italy sent troops, tanks, and planes to aid the nationalists. The Soviet Union contributed equipment and supplies to the Republicans, who also received help from the Mexican government, can you believe it, of all places. And mind you, the Mexican government at the time, back in the 1930s, about 15 years before this war, the Mexicans themselves also had a very brutal civil war as well, which was led by, what was the guy's name? Pancho Villa. Yes. Pancho Villa was on the one side because Pancho Villa was pro the working class, but this is not the working class that Pancho Villa technically that you would think he would represent, like, you know, agricultural workers. No. There's something else in South America and in Central America known as Native American communities. And Pancho Villa represented a lot of these guys as well. They were not just farm workers. They were rural poor and all these other particular communities and peoples that at that stage, because Mexico was at least 100 years independent by that stage, by 1900, they were at least 100 years independent. Because there's no doubting it. I mean, much of South America was also by 1900 at least independent for like 75 years already. I mean, there's this wonderful documentary that I've watched specifically in terms of where the guy asks the question, why has Argentina never moved on to become a global south particular, sort of like powerhouse economically? And it's literally the one mistake that Namibia is pursuing that Argentina was actually caught out on. Reason being, and I'll factor this in quickly as a quick digression, guys. So, there's obviously a understanding in certain circles of the Namibian discourse who believe that Namibia should decouple itself from the South African rand, break away from SACU, and then go its own course, chart its own course. Now, no one knows what would happen because obviously, the proponents that are saying, you know, just decouple, just break away, do this and do that and do this and do that, they obviously not take into account in terms of the severe headwinds that Namibia itself could face from doing something like that, which could be self-inflicting damage. Could be. I say could be. Remember? Could be. The platform based upon that discussion is literally based upon, if you look at Namibia's economy, you can see a semblance in terms of, if you've ever read up or looked at a documentary in terms of why Argentina is such a weird economy. I'll call it weird because it is weird. It's such a weird economy versus the rest of the world. I'll explain it to you. So, in the explainer that was given to me in this documentary was that literally Argentina was one of those countries that revolted and got their independence pretty early from Spain in the 1800s. Yeah, in the 1800s, just during or after during or before or after the Napoleonic Wars that obviously took place from 1800 to 1812, or at most you can push it to 1824. And Argentina, Brazil, what we now know as Venezuela and Colombia and Ecuador, and there's someone else. There's another country I'm missing. And Bolivia. Those guys got their independence, you know, pretty straightforward, just like that. So Argentina had a large agricultural sector that was carrying it in the 1800s. And Argentina was exporting everywhere. They were exporting to the United States back then in the 1800s. They were exporting to Europe predominantly. And life was good. And the policymakers and economic planners of Argentina just said, okay, life is good. Let's just enjoy this life as it is. Those guys didn't account for a South Africa popping up. They didn't account for an Australia popping up. And they didn't account for their northern neighbor of Brazil also becoming as solid an economic base as it itself had also become. And they also didn't account for the Americans becoming self-reliant in the 1800s as well, because the Americans then started producing themselves, started supplying for themselves, and thus the Americans obviously led their own particular economic development in the 1800s as well. And Argentina didn't count for this. And Argentina didn't count for that the Europeans would be beating each other up so extensively in the 1800s that, you know, because they just thought, you know, things are nice. We'll just continue as is. And Argentina never diversified. And Argentina never invested into engineering, scientific services, and the likes in terms of upliftment and diversification and economic forward progression. Nothing. Argentina was supposed to be that economy, but it never materialized. The downside of all of what I'm just explaining to you right now, dear listeners, is literally, it is a precursor. It is literally an example of, if you don't try to move forward from a specific economic base, which was an agrarian based, or an agriculture based economy, because for some reason Namibia is now trying to get into that agriculture-based economy by trying to boost the economic agricultural production discussion. However, you need to move forward from this particular platform. Yes, install it, develop it, but you need to move forward. Because if you just stay stuck there, certain things could obviously happen, which are detrimental. However, that is an end to the digression. We take a quick musical break, dear listeners. We're about 3 minutes out from the top of the hour at 6 a.m. And this is my Sunday morning take here on your number one talk radio station, that being Eagle FM.
Lately serene. Shadows are scattered like rings of gold. And I'm watching the moonlight fade away. Gonna like a fading dream. Caught out in the darkest moments of our life. For the rest of my days, while it is lingering, come along with the sin. Let's suffer through the change.
I don't know how much air I got. I will never get used to this. Cause it ain't what it seems. And don't nobody check on me. It's a slow way to go all alone. How you get lonely even though you're surrounded by the ones you myself, saying these words. There's a hurt deep down in my soul, but I learned not to let it show. Do I need him? No. There's a price I'ma pay for hiding feelings I don't say. Keep my cool or lose my way.
try to talk to the wind, but just can't pretend. I'm a man, man without.
This then brings us back, dear listeners, from the particular musical break that we had just there. A little bit of Leon Bridges with the song Blue Mesas. Before that, it was a little bit of The War on Drugs with the song primarily known as... Wait for it. Old Skin in that regard. Now, where we left off with the Spanish Civil War discussion has been one based upon the impacts and ultimately the sides and ultimately where they recruited from and ultimately who were their support bases as well. So for the Republicans, the Soviet Union assisted and the international brigades that were started by the Communist Party in France. On the nationalist front, well, the who's who of the bad guys of Europe in modern day history were on that corner. Now, on the national side of things, they got boots. They got, no, not the shoe. They got the people wearing the shoe, the boot, you know. They got boots in the ground. They got hardware. They got aerial support. While the Soviets only sent equipment and supplies to the Republicans. And the poor Republicans had to rally up support internationally for international support. Hence the reason why I made the statement a little bit earlier that the famous American author Ernest Hemingway fought in this war. Because people have spoken about his particular contribution in this war, in not just being a wartime journalist, but actually being someone there on the front line. And it had been proven by his participation in the Second World War as well. He was literally someone shooting the gun as a journalist. Please don't do that. Please don't ever do that, guys. If you're trying to be an aspiring correspondent, don't ever do that. Because that's the quickest that you'll also become the target. However, in August of 1936, France joined Britain, the Soviet Union, Germany and Italy in signing a non-interventionist agreement that would be ignored by the Germans, the Italians and the Soviets. Now about 40,000 foreigners fought on the Republican side in the international brigades, largely under the command of the Comintern, and 20,000 others served in medical or auxiliary units. Now, by November of 1936, the nationalists had advanced to the outskirts of Madrid, which is the capital of Spain, just so that you know, if you did not know, if you don't know your geography. Now, they also laid siege to it, but were unable to get beyond the university city area. Now, they also captured the Basque northern provinces in the summer of 1937, and then also Asturias. And that's so... by October of that year, of 1937, remember? So it's from November 1936 to 1937, October, which is technically almost a full year period. That had been their particular sort of like advancement, that had taken place in that 1 year scenario. They also held on to the whole of the northern coast of Spain. Now then, a war of attrition actually began, because the nationalists drove a salient eastward through Teruel, one of the particular zones there in Spain, reaching the Mediterranean and splitting the Republic in two in April of 1938. And in December of 1938, they also moved upon Catalonia in the northeast, forcing the Republican armies then northward towards France. Now, by February of 1939, 250,000 Republican soldiers, together with an equal number of civilians, fled across the border into France. On 5 March of 1939, the Republican government then flew to exile in France. On 7 March, a civil war broke out in Madrid between communist and anti-communist factions, and by 28 March, all of the Republican armies had begun to disband or surrender, and the nationalist forces entered Madrid on that day. Now, the number of persons killed in the Spanish Civil War can be only roughly estimated, because nationalist forces put the figure at close to 1 million, including not only those killed in battle, but also the victims of bombardment, execution, and assassination. That's now the nationalists, Franco's people. But more recent estimates actually have been closer to 500,000 or less. And that this does not include all those who died from malnutrition, starvation, and war-engendered disease. Now, the political and emotional reverberations of the war also had far-reaching impacts, because it transcended those of a national conflict. For many in other countries, saw the Spanish Civil War as part of an international conflict between, depending on obviously the point of view of the person on the ground, tyranny and democracy, or fascism and freedom, or communism and civilization. As you can obviously see, you know, what was the kind of messaging taking place back then. For Germany and Italy, Spain was a testing ground for new methods of tank and air warfare. For Britain and France, the conflict represented a new threat to the international equilibrium. Oh yes, for Britain and France, who were themselves also colonial masters at the time, because, you know, everything should be just quiet enough for them to enjoy. Because in 1939 itself, this particular international equilibrium actually collapsed into what we now know as World War II. Now, the war also had mobilized many artists and intellectuals to take up arms. Among the most notable artistic responses to the war were the novels of Man's Hope of 1938 by André Malraux, Adventures of a Young Man in 1939 by John Dos Passos, and For Whom the Bell Tolls of 1940 by Ernest Hemingway. George Orwell's memoir of Homage to Catalonia in 1938, and Pablo Picasso's painting of Guernica, the bombing of Guernica itself, of 1937, and Robert Capa's photograph Death of a Loyalist Soldier, Spain, of 1936. Now, as I obviously mentioned there, dear listeners, you can obviously see the particular impact that this has had on the artists at the time, their views, their insights, their interpretations of these particular real-world events and developments, and it had, you know, significantly bad outcomes for them. Now, I want to zoom in specifically on the discussion of Ernest Hemingway, specifically of what I mentioned a little bit earlier. Now, I mentioned a whole bunch of artists, not just Hemingway himself, but Hemingway himself has been the only guy that I've seen, because obviously I've been exposed to a lot of particular American movies and media, and I didn't watch Ernest Hemingway movies that were based upon his life. I didn't watch them. But I've heard about Ernest Hemingway specifically because he was a war correspondent. He was a wartime journalist. He would go to war zones and he would report on them. I mean, if you've got to ask me to do something like that today, you'd better be paying me $1 million, you know, to go to a war zone and go and look and record. Because, guys, the thing, to be honest, what many people think happens in a conflict is not nice. I mean, if you've ever seen the documentaries specifically on YouTube about the people that thought going to Syria to fight for ISIS against and for the other particular rebel groups against Bashar al-Assad, you know, like what happened in the north of Syria and other parts, and was the eastern side of Syria, because Damascus is in the southern part of Syria. Many of those people thought it was hunky-dory. It was going to be like playing Call of Duty. It's like a video game. You know, what could happen? I still remember a friend of mine making a joke like that, while we were on varsity, because he said, "Dwight, do you know how many guys think just because they play a video game that a war, a conflict, a battle is like playing Call of Duty or Medal of Honor, the two video game franchises of the time?" And I asked him, "What do you mean?" Now, I won't mention my friend's name, obviously, but I asked him, "What do you mean?" He said, "I always read the comments in, because there's these online chat room platforms, like you get Discord. Discord is the one platform. The other one's name is 4chan, the oldest one. The other one's name is Reddit, because I've got Reddit. The other one's name is, there's another international. And then obviously there's the chat platforms, you know, below in places like, in social media platforms like YouTube and the likes." And many people back then thought, like what my friend explained, it was like, the guys think it's like playing a Call of Duty game, that you know what, a bullet really doesn't do that much damage. And it's not, guys. War has never been a romantic thing. I will still explain to you guys the very weird documentary that I watched about the start of the American Civil War that took place in the 1800s. There were literally people that thought, because they've never seen a war, they've never seen people die in conflict, that literally thought that, okay, this is going to be a picnic outing. We can come and have a seat here, you know, and see, you know, ultimately what a conflict looks like. Literally, that is what happened in that very first battle of the American Civil War. Now, the narrators, the researchers obviously explained it like, when the first battle of the American Civil War broke out, there was like a hill. If you now obviously on the side, it would have been to your left or to your right, depending on which side obviously you were on the battlefield. And artists showed up. Some people showed up there with their wives and friends, you know, and thought it would be like a spectacle, you know, like a social spectacle to come and see, you know, what is a conflict? What does a battlefield look like? Mind you, this is against the Confederate Army, which was Southern America, and the Southern, not South America, Southern America, and the Union Army of Northern America. These guys roll up with hardware, cannons, cavalries, musket rifles. They're still fighting that, what's that thing called, you know, that, they were fighting that specific method, man, that the Europeans invented, where you march up to about like 200 meters, 300, 400 meters away from each other, and then they would start shooting at each other. And then obviously you give off the first volley, and from the first volley you then charge at each other. Those people that came to sit and party on that hill, they were traumatized. They were traumatized. Now, when I myself saw this particular discussion, because, I mean, I've been reading about history, and specifically most history is based upon wartime events and conflict scenarios and who fought who existed where, and so stuff like that. And everywhere, every notion, every single indication of a conflict, I will tell you now, dear listeners, I'll probably be the biggest anti-conflict, anti-war. It's one of the reasons also why I'm a very diplomatic person. Because I know no one enjoys pain. No one enjoys suffering. And war is literally such a particular manifestation that is highly detrimental to any particular positive growth that you wish to envisage. And let alone a civil war in its own right. Let alone a civil war, which is also significant. Now, I found a specific sort of like a journal extraction from a particular academic journal, which was the IAFOR Journal of Arts and Humanities of 2019. This is volume 1, issue 1. Volume 6, issue 1, which was titled as Ernest Hemingway and His Unconventional Role in World War II. And this was based upon, I'll just read you the abstract. It was based upon Ernest Hemingway's particular involvement in the Second World War, primarily because it helps to also shape, you know, what happened. And if none of you know ultimately who Ernest Hemingway is, go look up the man. The guy lived in, what was the country's name? Because he lived somewhere in South America or in the Caribbean. He literally lived outside of the United States because, literally because of, you know, his exposure to conflict. While Ernest Hemingway, this is not the abstract that I'm reading, while Ernest Hemingway is often viewed as one of the United States' greatest writers, the heterogeneous features of his life experience can surprise readers who are simply familiar with his literary production. Now, although he officially served as a correspondent in World War II, Hemingway wrote only 5 articles during his time in Europe in 1945 and 1944. Much of his time away from writing was spent participating in irregular warfare. Now, while Hemingway officially denied the charges made against him by other correspondents, Hemingway's private correspondence reveals that he actually did, in fact, actively engage in the war effort. Now, indeed, as a reward for his heroics, Hemingway was decorated with the Bronze Star Medal, which is the highest military award available to a civilian. The official citation credited Hemingway with courage while bringing the reality of war to his readers. His battlefield heroics could not be mentioned in the citation because it was against the Geneva Convention for correspondents, meaning journalists, wartime reporters, to literally be engaged in military actions. Now, there's also no doubt, however, that such actions did take place. And while Hemingway's actions were illegal, they undoubtedly helped the U.S. forces advance in France. Sundry skills, from his knowledge of French to his ability to read maps and understand terrain, proved highly useful to U.S. military commanders in the area. That's just the extract that I'm reading from, the abstract that I'm reading from that particular research paper right there regarding Ernest Hemingway's particular contribution in the Second World War effort. Now, the platform, obviously, dear listeners, is one that is based upon a scenario of, so, you know, what does this actually also spell? What does this actually mean? Well, the scenario has been one of the most, if you can call it, the most inflammable situation that existed in the world at that time. Now, there were similarly such highly flammable scenarios across the world. One obviously being the discussion of what happened in 1915 during the First World War, when the Russians had to pull out of the First World War. Now, if you don't know why the Russians pulled out of the First World War, I'm going to tell you right now. Specifically because the Russian Revolution had occurred. And they were first known as the Bolsheviks, not as the communists, the Bolsheviks. And Lenin had instructed the army generals to withdraw from the First World War, because he literally said, or whoever said that, I'm taking over from the royalty, the monarchy in Russia, withdraw from this war. It's not our war. And so they withdrew, the Russian army. And when they withdrew, here's where the flammable situation, or the potentially flammable situation, sprung up. Britain, during the particular conflict, as the Russian army withdrew from the First World War, the British sent soldiers to Russia. They were literally British soldiers on Russian soil. They sailed in, it's literally as you sail in here past Denmark, Norway, Sweden, then Finland, then to that, there where St. Petersburg is, there was a landing area there. They sent soldiers there. Why? How do I know? Many people don't know this, but, it was an agreement between the kings and the monarchs of Europe at the time. The French also sent soldiers there. I think, and the Germans had soldiers there as well. Literally the same belligerents of the First World War literally sent a contingent of soldiers to Russia. And all these guys did, they just went and camped, set up a fort, a base, and they just stayed there. Until, you know, awaiting orders, you know, obviously. That's not what many people know. Many people don't know this. But it literally, and that was a flammable situation. So the First World War could have expanded in the Russian neighborhood of things because of the Russian army withdrawing from the First World War because the Russian Revolution had taken place. The other particular obvious flammable situations already kicked off. We know about them. The Korean War. The Vietnam War. What was the other one's name? There was another highly contentious war. Just need to remember that war. Oh. The battle that India and China had between themselves when, you know, regarding their border. And then the war between India and Pakistan. When Pakistan broke away, or not when Pakistan broke away, literally when Bangladesh became independent, Pakistan and India had a war. And then you also had the particular indication of obviously, you know, there was another war that I'm thinking of. But obviously, as you can see, these particular developments were pretty severe. Because they were pretty severe. Now, we'll quickly be taking a short musical break, dear listeners, and after the musical break, we'll be coming back, heading into some of the particular insights. For example, getting to understand who Francisco Franco was, the nationalist general in the Spanish Civil War, which actually became Spain's dictator for such a long time. After that, or after this musical break, we'll be back with that particular contribution right there. And you're in my company, dear listeners, all the way from 5 a.m. up to 7 a.m. And it's currently right now almost 6:30 a.m. And for some reason, I still don't see the sun coming out in that notion. But nonetheless, it still is a little bit of a nice, chilly morning. Obviously, depending on where you are. But nonetheless, good morning if you've woken up. I do hope you've got a cup of coffee close to you, and we'll see each other after this musical break. ¶¶
seem to be in charge of life. Ooh, so baby, let's get it on. Drinking wine and killing time, sailing the summer sun.
Obviously coming back, dear listeners, from the sounds there of Jamiroquai with 7 Days in June. Before that, you had a little bit of The War on Drugs again with the song Pain. And that brings us about 20 minutes out from the top of the hour at 7 a.m. Now, primarily getting back in terms of starting understanding the, you know, the pertinent discussions, obviously, or talking points that obviously emanated from this. Now, obviously, Franco won the Spanish Civil War. He won the conflict, as I outlined to you specifically, the moves that happened and developed. Now, his full name was Francisco Franco Bahamonde, and specifically, he was the Spanish general who led the nationalist forces in overthrowing the Second Spanish Republic during the Spanish Civil War. And thereafter ruled over Spain from 1939 to 1975 as a dictator, assuming the title of caudillo. Caudillo speaks, translates to, is a type of a personalist leader, wielding military and political power. So you can technically think, who else did the same thing? There were two other guys, one from Italy, one from Spain. Aye, one from Germany. This particular period in Spanish history from the nationalist victory of Tum Franco's death is commonly known as the Francoist Spain era or as the Francoist dictatorship era that happened in Spain. Because obviously, you know, Franco, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, Franco was a career soldier. His first job was in the army. Because, he was born in the area of Galicia, which is in Spain, into an upper class military family because his family was already in the army. And Franco served in the Spanish army as a cadet in the Toledo Infantry Academy from 1907 to 1910. And while serving in Morocco, he also rose to the ranks to become a brigadier general in 1926 at the age of 33. Now, 2 years later on, Franco became the dictator of the General Military Academy, or the director, not the dictator, sorry, the director of the General Military Academy in Zaragoza. And as a conservative and a monarchist, Franco regretted the abolition of the monarchy and the establishment of the Second Republic in 1931. So he didn't like the idea of the Second Republic. He also didn't like it that the Spanish monarchy technically had to be abolished, as a ruling class in Spain. And he was actually also devastated by the closing of his academy, but nevertheless, he also continued his service in the Republican army. So he did work for the Republicans, Franco. Now, his career was then further boosted after the right-wing SEDA and PRR won the 1933 election, empowering him to lead the suppression of the 1934 uprising in Asturias. So, the 1934 uprising in Asturias was also known as the Asturian Revolution, and it was a major conflict that happened in Asturias from 4 October to 19 October, and it started with a mass strike action undertaken by miners from a local mining company against the new government, which included the conservative SEDA party. Now, the strike and subsequent demonstrations eventually developed into a violent fallout. Now, Franco was briefly elevated to the Chief of Army Staff before the 1936 election and moved the leftist party, the leftist Popular Front, actually into power, that specific election. Now, this ultimately relegated Franco to the Canary Islands. Initially reluctant, he also joined the July 1936 military coup. Now, I remember when I mentioned earlier that I said, you know, the Spanish Civil War actually broke out because of a failed coup. Well, what happened was the Spanish coup of 1936 was a military uprising that was intended to overthrow the Spanish Second Republic, but it precipitated the Spanish Civil War. It literally led to the Spanish Civil War. The nationalists then began fighting against the Republicans for the control of Spain. Now, as he obviously joined this particular coup, which, after failing to take Spain, sparked the Spanish Civil War. During the war, he commanded Spain's African colonial army, and later on, following the deaths of much of the rebel leadership, became the faction's only leader, being appointed a generalissimo and head of state in 1936. He then consolidated all national parties, or nationalist parties, into what was known as the Fete de las Unions, meaning creating a one-party state, and developed a cult of personality around his rule by founding the Movimiento Nacional. 3 years later, the nationalists then declared victory, which extended Franco's dictatorship over Spain through a period of repression of political opponents. Franco's dictatorship's use of forced labor, concentration camps, and executions led to between 30,000 to 50,000 deaths. Combined with wartime killings, it would bring the death toll of the White Terror, ultimately the White Terror being the Francoist repression, the death toll of the White Terror to between 100,000 to 200,000, and that during the Second World War, Franco maintained Spanish neutrality. But he actually supported the Axis powers. He supported Nazi Germany, and he supported fascist Italy, because it's almost like a compensation, or, you know, almost like refunding someone. In recompense, to Italy and Germany for their support during the Civil War. Now, this did damage Spain's international reputation in many ways. During the start of the Cold War, because remember, he led from the country from 1939 to 1975. So at the start of the Cold War, which literally began, I think, in 1950, Franco lifted Spain out of its mid-20th century economic depression through technocratic and economically liberal policies. Presiding over a period of accelerated growth that was known as the Spanish Miracle. And at the same time, his regime also transitioned from a totalitarian state to an authoritarian one with limited pluralism. Now, Franco then became a leader in the anti-communist movement, which was actually gathering support in the West. And the West started supporting him on that. It's the same thing that also happened in Japan. It's the same thing that also happened in before China became predominantly communist, with China's own particular like civil war scenario. The West supported the guys that ran to Taiwan. If you guys do not know, they did that. And Franco then, as mentioned, obviously started gathering support from the West, particularly from the United States. Now, as the dictatorship began to relax its hardline policies, Luis Carrero Blanco became Franco's Eminence Grise. Now, Eminence Grise, or Grey Eminence, is a powerful decision maker or an advisor who actually operates covertly in a non-public or unofficial capacity. It's a very powerful advisor. Now, this Blanco gentleman's particular role expanded after Franco began struggling with Parkinson's disease in the 1960s. By 1973, Franco resigned as Prime Minister, separated from the office of Head of State since 1967, and due to his advanced age and illness. But still, Franco still remained in power as the Head of State and as Commander-in-Chief. So that when Franco died in 1975 at the age of 82, and was entombed in the Valle de los Caídos, Franco actually restored the monarchy in his final years, being succeeded by Juan Carlos, King of Spain, the previous King of Spain, not the current King of Spain, the previous King of Spain, who actually led the Spanish transition to democracy. Now, the legacy of Franco in Spanish history remains controversial, as the nature of his dictatorship had changed over time. His reign was also marked by both brutal repression, with tens of thousands that were killed, economic prosperity, which greatly improved the quality of life in Spain, and his dictatorial style also proved adaptable enough to allow social and economic reform, but still centered on a highly centralized government, authoritarianism, nationalism, national Catholicism, anti-Freemasonry, and anti-communism. So obviously, these particular highlights that were sort of like the main features of Franco's particular way of, primarily dealing or participating in the affairs of Spain, and for Spain's particular prosperity and for Spain's particular sort of like rebuilding scenario was key. That ultimately leads us. Or brings us to the end of the discussion, but it actually leads us into our next particular musical break. Dear listeners, do stay tuned while we take a short musical break.
Kisses to cut through the gloom with a cough drop. tricolored town. You were sitting in the car with the coats all piled high, and I thought you might be mine. In a small world, I'm an exception, the rainy Tuesday night, in the right place and time. Yeah, you made it all right. I got a feeling I might have lit the very few that you were trying not to lie. You were a stranger in my phone book. I was acting like I knew, 'cause I had nothing to lose. When the winter's in full swing and your dreams just aren't coming true, it ain't funny what y'all do.
When you see what's coming, all the turning for our clock. When you know who's calling, even though we're not the rooftop. When you walk to real, you ask where you must have your roof. You're me,
The breeze, I need to feel elements to remind me. There's beauty when it's bleak. Stuck out long before lights down. What do I breathe? Oh, I know the more that I love, the less that I feel. The times that I jump never were real. They say that all scars heal, but I know maybe I won't. But the waves won't break my boat. But the waves won't break my boat. Crash on the boardwalk, the wind rush through the trees. I keep my eyes peeled, the memories always fall short of what we could have been. Left out long before last call. What do I need? Oh, I know the more that times that I jumped never were real. Say that all scars heal, but I know maybe I won't. But the waves won't break my boat. But the waves won't break my boat. Won't break my boat. Won't break my boat. The more that I love, the less that I feel. The times that I jumped never were real. Say that all scars will heal, but I know maybe I won't. And the waves won't break my boat.
And that there were the sounds of Ed Sheeran with the song Boat. And that ultimately brings us up to the end, as mentioned a little bit earlier, dear listeners, to this morning's programming and that of my Sunday morning take. We'll still continue with some of the particular tunes before the next program takes over. And on that note, enjoy the rest of your morning in our particular company. This for this last April Sunday in April. You know, I just sort of like mixed up those two particulars right there. But nonetheless, welcoming you if you've just woken up, and ultimately also wishing you a wonderful Sunday in our company, specifically in your number one talk radio station. This has been my Sunday morning take, and we continue with some of the particular tracks here on your number one talk radio station.
Dejaste de querer. necesitaba. Cuando más falta hacía, tú me diste la espalda. Cabrón, pero me están notando el corazón. Estás apretando mucho, mami, déjalo. Si quieres te doy la razón. Yo lo único que quiero es largarme de aquí. Me da igual dónde puedes elegir. Algún día dentro de poco me voy a arrepentir de haberte confesado lo que me hace sufrir. Tú me dejaste de querer cuando menos lo esperaba. Cuando más te quería, se te fueron las ganas. Está loco por ti, perdiendo apuestas. Dime en quién piensas cuando te acuestas. Porque yo pienso en ti, son ilusiones. Yo pienso en ti, son ilusiones. Porque yo pienso en ti, son ilusiones. Yo pienso en ti, son ilusiones. Tú me dejaste de querer cuando te necesitaba. Cuando más falta a ti, tú me diste la paz. Se te fueron las
Did you know that in Namibia, over 1.4 million people use their mobile device to access the internet? So why not meet your current and potential customers where they already are? With over 600,000 cumulative users around the world, between the Eagle FM and Imba mobile apps, Eagle Media House has the perfect digital platforms for you to advertise your business, upcoming events, weddings, vacancies, funerals, or any other announcement that you have on their digital billboards in their mobile applications. Put your ad on our digital billboards and with one tap of the screen, lead users directly to an address of your choosing. For more information, contact Hende at 081-410-9077. That's 081-410-9077. Did you know that in Namibia, over 1.4 million people use their mobile device to access the internet? So why not meet your current and potential customers where they already are? With over 600,000 cumulative users around the world, between the Eagle FM and Imba mobile apps, Eagle Media House has the perfect digital platforms for you to advertise your business, upcoming events, weddings, vacancies, funerals, or any other announcement that you have on their digital billboards in their mobile applications. Put your ad on our digital billboards and with one tap of the screen, lead users directly to an address of your choosing. For more information, contact Hende at 081-410-9077. That's 081-410-9077.